Okay, so welcome everyone.
Did you turn on the little?
I did not turn on the little.
Oh, that's much louder. Whoa.
Okay, so
we've all arrived here.
That sounds strange. I'll move it a little further away.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll get used to this in a moment, I promise. So, we're here. It's great to see you all, and again, welcome. My name is Stephen Hick, and I'll be your teacher for this retreat. I'm from Ottawa, and have a sangha. Some people from the local sangha are here in Ottawa. I'm a new teacher with TNI, so it's wonderful to be doing this retreat with TNI. I've had teachers like Gregory Kramer, Thich Nhat Hanh. I notice some people have some experience with the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh. Ajahn Vaidarbha, I know some people are familiar with Ajahn. And Matthew Flickstein is my primary teacher who introduced me to teaching. Well, Gregory Kramer actually did, and I said I wasn't ready, but Matthew's talked me into it. He's a very determined fellow, so here I am, and I'm enjoying the Dharma teaching and experiencing being with people on their journey as they practice with these teachings. So I look forward to this. I look forward to doing a whole lot of nothing with you for a few days, which is what we'll be doing. I've got a quote from one of my favorite quotable people, Winnie the Pooh. Full of wise words. It was a Dharma teacher in his day. Don't underestimate the value of doing nothing, of just going along, listening to all the things you can't hear and not bothering. So we can practice the wise words of Winnie the Pooh over this New Year's retreat. So a whole lot of doing nothing, but a whole lot going on while we're doing it, and I'll get into that a little bit. It's always exciting to begin a retreat. I know for some of you it's your first retreat, for others it's one of many. But irregardless, it's always an exciting time, the beginning of the retreat, where we transition into a different way of being with our experience. You know, you're all physically here. We see each other's bodies here. And this transition is bringing our minds and our hearts here as well. And just settling into our experience, our direct experience. Just settling. Maybe just allowing your mind and your heart to just kind of land with your body here in this moment. It's really an emotional and a psychological transition that we go through when we begin this process. And we can ask ourselves, what does this mean to us to have this time, this precious time, to just practice? How precious it is. So we're here as well for New Year's. It may not be the typical image of what happens on New Year's, the conditioning that we've conditioned impression of a New Year's Eve. This may not be it. In fact, when you told people you were going on a silent retreat for New Year's, they might have gone, "What? What are you doing? Is there champagne while you do this?" Or then there isn't. and I'll talk more about that later when I talk about some of the guidelines. But we usually have a countdown and New Year's resolutions and so forth. So this will be quite different. And there may be times when you question, well, you're here, so why you're here as well. What am I doing here? I thought this would be fun. And it might be fun, but you never know what's going to come up with an experience like this, a silent retreat. But New Year's is a time for new beginnings, and we're going to talk a bit about that, and a letting go, as well as the possibility of setting some intentions for the year. And I'll talk tomorrow a little bit about perhaps the difference between a New Year's resolution and the setting of an intention. And what that could look like, and we'll actually play around with that tomorrow a lot more. We'll explore processes of setting intentions, which can be a real process that's of kindness and compassion with ourselves. So not perhaps a process where we, you know, I've got to do this, I've got to stop doing this, or I've got to do more of this to be a good person, and then we, of course. Many are unattained, let's put it that way. I think fitness facilities survive on the unattained resolutions that people pay for at the beginning of January, and at least that's what I'm told. So so we'll look at it perhaps a kinder and gentler way of being with our intentions and goals in our lives. I'd like to reinforce what Janet said about everyone is welcome. No matter what your life story is, your background, your level of experience with the practice, all different kinds of minds and bodies are here and are welcome to engage in this practice. As human beings, we're really exploring what it is to be a human being. We're exploring this being human. How our mind and bodies function. And it's always interesting to see what comes up in our minds and hearts when we're on retreat. Each of us is going to discover something very personal. More than likely. But what we're really, really discovering is what it's like to be human. In other words, our discoveries are universal. We may think, you know, these things that happen, no, these can't be happening to anybody else. But our experience is very universal. The Buddha talked about so many things that can possibly come up during this process of meditation. The five hindrances, for example. And if you've practiced meditation for any time, you see these five hindrances, in your practice. A very universal phenomenon. So if you sit down and you try to meditate and your mind just chatters away, this is not for me. I don't know if this whole medication thing, maybe it's for other people, but this mind is just doesn't stop. Well, one of the five hindrances is restlessness and a chattering mind. So it's very much a universal human experience. So each of us are going to discover all kinds of things. And when we sit in silence, it adds a specialness to our experience. We can discover our humanity in that process. Joy, compassion, kindness, and so forth. And the silence is very central to this process. So it's important that we honor the silence. It's actually very sacred. And when with the silence, we can really pause and we can tune into what's happening moment by moment. And maybe in your daily life, you've seen how difficult it can be to tune into your experience moment by moment when with so much going on. And this is on purpose. We've created an environment here where things are looked after for you. Your meals are prepared and you're fed. The teachings are provided. Everything you need is provided in as simple a form as we can make it. So that there's that sacred space for you to be with what's arising in your experience moment by moment. Just to be with your direct experience moment by moment. So it's important to honor that silence, not only for yourself, but for everyone here, of course. So we're going to use several practices, which I'll introduce over the course of the retreat. But it basically involves coming back to your staying with what's happening in each moment. Coming to your senses is sometimes said again and again and again, and allowing. There's sometimes a story that's told that illustrates being with things as they are, which is really what this practice is. So there's a person on a retreat, much like this kind of a retreat, who didn't like the other people on the retreat. So he left, and he went by a hut. By the way, you don't do that. He left and found a hut by a stream, and thought, "This I'll be away from all these people that I just don't like. Bother me. Can't practice around these people." Went to this hut by the stream, and the teacher and the retreat manager and the teacher went out to visit this person out in the hut by the stream, and they found him rearranging the stones in the stream. And they said, "What do you do? Why? What are you doing with the rearranging of the stones?" He said, "Well, I didn't like the sound of the water running over the stones." So we can't get away from our minds, even when we're on retreat. And perhaps that's what you really start to notice in the silence. You're really with your experience and your mind, and to allow that and be with it as best you can, and without judgment, as best you can. That's what allowing means. It's just allowing, giving it space. Allowing what arises to just be. And of course, if things get too difficult, overwhelming perhaps, we can also talk about skillful ways of relating to that as well. So it's important to bring a gentleness and self-compassion to this practice as well. So there may be a limit to what you can be with in terms of what's arising. And we can look at skillful ways of relating to what Jack Kornfield calls persistent visitors. Insistent visitors. Just visitors. Rumi said being human is like a guest house. Every day a new arrival. A joy, a meanness, a depression. So you never know what's going to arrive moment by moment. So I know several of you are fairly new. Well, we're actually kind of all over. There's people that have been on lots of retreats and people where it's actually the first retreat. So we've got I'm not sure I've ever done a retreat with such a wide range of experience. So this should be fun. So we have part of a retreat is creating a container for practice. And you actually feel and feed off the energy of the people that you're practicing with. I mean, that's why we have sitting groups that, you know, people drive through snowstorms to go to a church basement and sit together. It's because of this idea of community of practice and creating this container. So we have a group here that really can create this container of practice. I look at practice as having three fundamental things, and the Buddha talks about them as well, in the Eightfold Path and the five spiritual faculties, the seven factors of enlightenment, and so forth. So these are the typical kinds of things that are emphasized when we talk about practice and meditation practice. And by the way, I'll talk about the Buddha a lot in this retreat. Sometimes I quote other people, but one thing I've found is the Buddha has given very systematic instructions for meditation practice. The instructions are there in all spiritual traditions, and I think all spiritual traditions ultimately have the same message, the same truth. But I find for meditation practice, the Buddha had, you know, the lists. I don't know if you've come across them. I've mentioned a few of them already. Lots of these kind of very very systematic process. So I will quote the Buddha a fair bit in describing meditation. I look at three things as being crucial: a concentration, a mindfulness, and investigation. And you hear a lot about mindfulness. It's very popular in the media. I mean, it's when I started practicing it, nobody knew what mindfulness was, and now it's hard not to find somebody, you know, anywhere at a hockey game that doesn't know what mindfulness is, have some idea. Perhaps it's a misconception of what mindfulness is, but has heard something about it, and that there are some benefits that can come about from this practice. Don't hear as much about concentration and investigation. I think all three are crucial and need to be balanced. So we need to have concentration, mindfulness, and investigation. So I'll just go through each of those fairly rapidly. You know, some of you must be tired from the drive. I just noticed too that it's snowing again. So it's like the universe opened up this little window of time for people to drive from Toronto to Ottawa. It snowed like anything, stopped, roads got cleared, you got here, and now it's snowing again. And if we look at the forecast, it's going to be all cloud and cleared for you to then get back home again. So I will try to keep this somewhat brief, because I can talk about those three things for hours. So concentration, or samadhi, as it's called in Pali, is allowing the mind to settle and calm. Now, concentration practice is kind of a bit of a double-edged sword, because you can think, well, I have to do this and really try hard to do this, which then defeats the process of it happening. The idea of calming the mind is really allowing the mind to not trying too hard, because what you really try hard to do and resist tends to persist, right? So if you want to get rid of those thoughts, what are they going to do? They're going to think even more. But concentration is a important practice. It's kind of like, you know, if you had a glass of water with some dirt in it, and then you shook it all up, and you can't really see through it. But if you just, you know, put the glass down and let it settle, the mud sediment slowly settles to the bottom of the glass, and now you have clear water and the ability to clearly see. So it's kind of like that, just allowing that process to settle, allowing the mind to settle without fighting with it. Another analogy I like is, you know, sometimes the mind is just so active that, you know, trying to concentrate on the breath, the mind just gets more active. You might want to just let the mind be. Kind of like a horse that's overexcited. If you put it in a stall, it'll just kick. It'll just get more agitated. But if you put the horse out into an open field and let it run and buck, and eventually it settles down. So the mind can be a bit like a wild horse. And so just allowing it can be very helpful. Meditation's not about blankness. It's not about blanking out the mind. That's probably one of the biggest misconceptions I come across when I sometimes tell people I'm a meditation teacher or a Dharma teacher. Often I don't say anything because I know the questions will start coming. If you're sitting on a plane, what do? I'm retired. But, you know, sometimes you say, oh yeah, I'm a Dharma teacher, a meditation teacher. And the one misconception that comes out most often is it's about blanking out the mind and stopping thoughts. So it's not a blankness. Concentration is more of a sorting. In fact, more of a magnifying of mindfulness. So the mindfulness practice is magnified with the concentrated mind. And there's different levels of concentration. And some teachers will emphasize concentration more than other teachers. You know, Sayadaw Pak, the Burmese teacher, really emphasizes one-pointedness and what's called the jhanas and just this absorption practice. Somebody like Mahasi Sayadaw, another Burmese teacher, will emphasize access concentration. It's the mind that's concentrated enough that there is an awareness of what's happening moment by moment. And other people like Sayadaw Tanjaniya will not really talk about concentration a whole lot. We'll just mention it and really emphasize mindfulness. But we'll be beginning the retreat with some concentration practices. And I think it's often a weak link in our practice. If you really, you know, if you look at the suttas, all the different ones, concentration is mentioned more than mindfulness. So there is an emphasis on this allowing the mind to settle. Mindfulness, the second one, is being present for whatever arises in the present moment, non-judgmentally, allowing, trusting, accepting what's arising in the present moment. So it's bare attention to what's occurring in the present moment. And what is it bare of? It's bare of judgment, decision, identification, commentary. It's just being with what is arising. There's a thought. There's a body sensation. There's a sound. Another body sensation. Being with the flow of our direct experience, moment by moment. I won't talk as much about mindfulness because I think people are more familiar with that, with sati or mindfulness. Investigation is the third variable or element that I'd like to talk a bit about, which is the non-cognitive exploration of our direct experience. So it's the whole idea of... You know, So it's not thinking about or analyzing. Which is, when you hear that word investigation, the first thing that often comes to mind is people think, oh, I'm going to analyze what's happening. If you want to do that, you can go to a psychotherapist and analyze your experience, which has some value, but it's not what we're doing in the meditation practice. It's more like being in a dark room and turning on a light, and you see what's in the room. It's just seeing. The Pali is Dhamma Vikara, which actually means kind of a sorting out. So it's kind of a sorting of your experience. It could mean like, well, I find that doing that leads to this. So if I watch violent television, I tend to be a little agitated, or perhaps quicker to be angry. If I listen to soft jazz, I tend to be calmer, less prone to. So gee, it's that kind of sorting. So you're kind of investigating what is skillful and wholesome in your life, what leads to well-being. There's that aspect of it. There's also the idea of, you know, coming and seeing for yourself. One of my favorite kind of quotes from the Buddha is, you know, come see for yourself. So this isn't a practice of me telling you what to believe or telling you what you should feel, but it's you investigating your own experience as a human being and seeing what's there. Bringing an intense curiosity and openness to what's there, to this being human. We're exploring this being human. And when you can touch the deepest parts of what it is to be human, you really, there's a real freedom in that. And you see the freedom in this is what happens to human beings. So when somebody gets angry, at a staff meeting, somebody blows up, the reaction might be to get angry back. And you see this is a human being who's, through various causes and conditions, anger has arisen in them, and hold that with compassion, because it's happened. You've seen that clearly happen in yourself. If the particular causes and conditions are there, so it can bring a real compassion to the way one is in the world. I think that's all I'll say about the practice. Hopefully I didn't stuff too much stuff in there to make it more confusing than it actually is. I mean, really, you're just sitting there doing a whole lot of nothing. You're sitting there just, you know, watching what arises. Watching the mind, heart, and sorting through what's arising. So we have, balancing those three is really important. So not having too much of one. I say this, my father always said I was the, I learned everything the hard way. Don't know if it, in other words, somebody told me that if I jumped off the roof with a sheet, you know, with four strings, that it wouldn't actually hold me and I would hurt myself. I would actually have to get that sheet and jump off the roof just to see. And so I obviously hurt myself quite often doing these kinds of things. But I took that attitude to meditation. So the good thing about that is if you have a problem, I've probably experienced it, like in your meditation practice, because I've tried everything. So I've had each one of those aspects out of balance. So I've had concentration emphasized and, you know, just trying to bliss out and blank the mind. I've had mindfulness emphasized where I'd go through my day very slowly and I'd do everything. And, you know, just that was my, you know, overemphasis on an investigation where, you know, I was just constantly trying to sort through my experience, but not with a very settled mind. So it's really having those in balance is crucial. Is helpful in this practice. So we have a schedule. You've all seen the schedule. We're going to do nothing in a very organized way.
Yeah.
So I encourage you to really dive into the schedule and be with the schedule. There's lots of space in this schedule. It's part of a New Year's retreat, as there's more space for you to practice on your own. For those that are new to the practice, continually engage in the practice, whether you're walking, eating, sitting. Every moment of the schedule is a moment to practice, not just the formal sitting periods or the formal movement periods, but every moment. So I invite you to embrace this schedule. Janet also talked about devices. So I invite you to give your device a retreat as well, or devices. Some people may have brought more than one, the tablet and the phone, maybe three, the laptop and the tablet and the phone. I don't know. I don't think tablets and laptops will fit in the basket we have, but I can rest assured that Janet will guard these devices with her life, I'm sure. You'd have to do something pretty severe to get those out of Janet's hands, I think. They'll be well cared for while they take their retreat as well. So I encourage you to do that. This is new. The Buddha, 2,500 years ago, they didn't have. It's always new things coming up. So this is a new pull away from being with what is. Because there will be pulls away from it. I talked about, reading things on the wall. I remember a retreat where I wanted to distract from what was arising in my mind. I read an exit sign like 15 times, and then I realized, wow, that's really, you really want to, what are you avoiding, looking at here? So I paused and did some investigation. But there's this pull. And been on retreats where that pull is really strong, and I've had that, phone, and I've come up with really, really rational, even compassionate reasons why I should pull out that phone and look at the email. And you may be coming up with really rational and compassionate reasons why you shouldn't put the phone in the basket. This and that and the other thing. And there may be real reason. There may be a reason, like if there's an emergency occurring in your family and so forth, that it's appropriate to keep a device. But for the most part, I encourage you to let go and give your device a retreat to. Really creating this environment where you can really explore the mind-heart. The other thing that we have on the schedule is optional group meetings. So there's just too many to do individual meetings. So I've done optional ones. Again, more New Year's retreat, there's kind of more space to explore your practice in your unique way. But there is this opportunity, and I really encourage people that are new to the practice to take advantage of those group meeting spaces. I believe there's two of them, one each day on the schedule. And this is your opportunity to ask questions. Like if, you know, what concentration, what is that? Or whatever comes up. Or maybe something's coming up in your sittings or in your daily practice. Something's arising, you know, what is this? And we can look at skillful ways to relate to what's coming up in your practice, ways to encourage the practice for it to blossom. So again, especially those that are new to insight meditation, Vipassana, which is what we're practicing here, if you're new to that, then I really encourage you to come to those optional groups. So the other thing I'd like to talk about is the the guidelines or precepts for the practice. Excuse me. So part of Janet talked a lot about the importance of the environment that we're creating here for practice. And this is another aspect of that environment. So the cultivation of the mind heart of this practice can only happen in a field of safety and non-harming. So there's these guidelines, and these are guidelines that I didn't make them up. In fact, none of this is Janet or I never really made up any of this. It's based on thousands year old traditions. So if one of them doesn't sit right with you, you know, write a letter to the Buddha. And I'm just kidding. You can, of course, approach us. If my humor gets on your nerves as well, you feel free to write a note to the Buddha, because, so these precepts have been around for a long time. There's, you know, they're kind of trainings or guidelines. And all spiritual traditions have versions of this. Some state them more as moral laws. These are stated more as trainings that we engage in and practice with. In other words, we're not going to be perfect with them. We train and we sort of see where we fall off the rails on it. So they're training precepts. And they're supportive of our practice and help facilitate the practice. Can't kind of overemphasize the importance of the ethical or moral trainings within this practice. It does a lot more than create an environment for non-harming. It actually really encourages our practice, encourages a concentrated mind. If you notice what comes up when the mind is settling, if you've done something that there's some remorse about, guess what's going to come up when you're sitting? It can be the smallest little thing, too, that comes up. So these practices are crucial for your own, these guidelines are crucial for your own practice as well as for the community of practice. We're going to be very simple and kind with each other in this community. And often we might mess up, and together we can see how we can forgive ourselves and forgive each other and move on. That's also part of the practice, is how we relate to messing up. How we can love ourselves while we mess up. That's what I love about the idea of training guidelines as opposed to
moral laws. And a law, I kind of feel like, oh, geez, I messed that one up. You know, maybe I'm not good enough for this. But with these, you explore what came up. What were the causes and conditions? Perhaps some investigation. What were the causes and conditions around this messing up that happened? Messing up, it's just what arose, right? So I'm going to offer five guidelines that the Buddha suggested. First one, avoid harming or killing other beings. Killing's pretty straightforward, each other and stuff. But it includes insects, bugs, I mean, goes as far as non-harming to the other creatures in our environment, insects and animals. So really a non-harming environment. The freedom to be free of the fear of being harmed in this environment. So a real gift of trust that we can give to each other. So avoiding harming. Excuse me. Avoiding or refraining from taking what is not given could be interpreted as meaning, you know, not stealing things from one another. But it can be more. It could be much more subtler than that. Seeing a pen that looks like it might be a pen that, you know, there's a bunch of them. It looks like it's a public bunch of pens. They'll just take one. They might not belong to us. They might belong to the retreats. So just being very sensitive to not refraining from taking what is not given. Things on our cushions and so forth. The third one is refrain from sexual activity. It's sometimes refrain from misuse of our sexual energy. But here we're in kind of like a mini monastery. And part of the invitation is to refrain from all sex, to become celibate for a few days. Explore what that's like, to hear that and to be with that practice. Often on retreat, the invitation is to not misuse our sexual energy. But I'm kind of extending that and offering you the invitation to not practice any sexual activity for the duration of the retreat. See what arises when I say that. You can be really interested in what's coming up, but it's not acting on it. I offer this because another teacher offered this, a retreat I was with my wife, but it was a much longer one. I don't know if I can do this. But it was interesting to watch the mind just kind of, oh, wow, this is not my usual practice. And to watch how the mind dealt with that and what came up with it. So that's why I sort of extend this invitation to you as well. The fourth one is around speech. The Buddha was big on speech. It had its own category in the Eightfold Path. I mean, it could have just, this is right action. Well, speech could be considered an action, but it had its own category, right? Speech. So there's a real emphasis on speech throughout many of the suttas. And there's a reason for speech is powerful. Here we're letting go of speaking. Verbally, we're writing notes, so wise speech would come into our note writing to really really explore what is coming up in that process of writing the note and being very mindful as that arises. So here we're meeting ourselves. So there's no speech. So who am I when I'm not telling other people who I am? Really exploring who am I when I'm not talking about who I am? When I did some practice with wise speech, it really struck me how much I talked about who I am when I was talking to other people. So what is left in the silence? What is left is what's actually true. In each moment, what's left is what's actually true. It's like a purification of the mind, just being with yourself in the silence. You can even let go of self-talk. In other words, letting means because your mind is going to do what it does. Are you believing what the mind says? A thought can arise and pass away. As soon as it becomes a believed thought, you're in. you're there with it. It becomes your experience. So with noticing what thoughts are believed and what thoughts are just passing through in terms of your self-talk. So it's an opportunity just to be with your direct experience. So I'm taking this guideline a little further. Really, it's just around not speaking. Pretty much the guideline. But I'm extending it into other areas of looking at self-talk and the process of writing notes if you do that. And the fifth one is refraining from using substances that cloud the mind, i.e. recreational drugs. So it's an invitation to refrain from any recreational substances. And I'm not saying that these things are evil in any way, but rather for the purposes of what's conducive to a meditation practice. The invitation is to explore what it's like not to do meditation practice without recreational drugs. I know there was an era when, you know, there's lots of this happening, but it's actually one of the things the Buddha emphasized was being with, having a pure mind, having our mind unobscured, unclouded in the process of practicing mindfulness and investigation. This doesn't, this doesn't include prescription medication. If you're on necessary prescription medication, then by all means continue. So these are the five basic precepts or guidelines that I invite you to practice with, to train with, to look at. How you're doing in relation to these five guidelines, and not only for your own benefit, for the benefit of everyone. As I said, it creates the container for our practice. I'm actually going to do something I wasn't planning on doing. I'm going to ask if there are any questions, particularly about the practice as I described it, or any question. Yeah?
Would you mind elaborating on concentration? and how to develop it and techniques maybe.
Okay. Did everybody hear that question? Elaborate on it. No, you don't need the microphone. So elaborating on any techniques for concentration practice. And we will be exploring those, particularly at the beginning. One of the, and we can do it right now, well, I'll just do like a little mini practice. Don't expect your mind to go thump, but it might. You never know. I think just find a comfortable posture. And posture is very important for this practice, that we find an alert, relaxed, but alert posture. So that's kind of, so you want to have a sense of being settled in and relaxed, but also alert. So you're not going to drought to sleepiness. That's, I think, one of the reasons why, you know, the meditation postures have these kind of grounding. You're either grounded on your in a triangle, or you're grounded in a on your knees if you're on a bench or a cushion, or your feet are grounded flat on the. If you're in a chair, your feet are flat on the ground, so your legs aren't crossed, and your hands can just be resting on your thighs, or they can be cupped in front of you. Whatever you find most comfortable. And I think I'm going to emphasize for the new folks, comfortable. Because, you know, you can work with pain during a meditation, but it might not be the thing you want to start with in terms of your practice. You want to, usually, you know, our sits are sitting there for 45 minutes, so you really want to knows a posture that allows you to sit for the period of 45 minutes without too much movement. Because the body and mind are connected, and as the body's moving around, the mind will jump around, be more likely to jump around as well. So the first thing is the posture. And just coming into your experience in this moment, and inviting you to close your eyes if that feels comfortable for you. Noticing that you're breathing, that breathing is occurring. The breath is always there. You're breathing in and you're breathing out. It's a constant flow. So the breath is always available and rather interesting object to place your attention on. And you can place your attention on the breath by feeling the sensations in the body, where the breath occurs most easily for you. So where do you feel the breath most easily and naturally? Where is it most predominant? Is it sensations at the tip of your nose? Is it sensations of the belly rising and falling? Or the chest? Just tuning into those sensations of breathing. Not trying to manipulate or change the breath in any way, but just allowing the breath to breathe itself. Starts to think about something else, perhaps planning for the future or something about the past, and just noticing that that's what the mind does, what the mind did. And perhaps even congratulating yourself for having noticed. That's a moment of mindfulness. That's what the practice is all about. And gently but firmly escorting your attention back to the breath, the sensations in the body of the breath. And if your mind wanders 100 times, then your only job is to, when you notice, gently come back to the breath. And so that's a basic framework for mindfulness of breathing or awareness of breath practice, which is how I start all my meditations. And the breath is just, as your practice goes into awareness of other objects like sounds or body sensations or thoughts, the breath is always there as an anchor, kind of anchor you back into the present moment. Because the breathing is taking place in the present moment. And some teachers will, perhaps you're sitting and the mind is particularly active, jumping from tree to tree like a monkey, call it monkey mind sometimes, jumping from thought to thought. Some teachers may recommend counting breaths. It's really a way to, it gives the mind something else to do. And so you just count, breathing in, one, breathing out, two, breathing in, three, breathing out, four. And you can count your way up to 10 and then start over again. And if the mind wanders during that process, you just start over again at 1. So you can open your eyes and come back to the question and answer. I sometimes find it easier to just demonstrate a practice rather than describe it. So there's just a couple of ways. I mean, generally the breath seems to be the object that is used most frequently for the beginning of a practice and allowing the mind to settle, to concentrate. If you have issues with breathing, asthma, or just you've had a history with difficult breathing, then you pick a different object. It can be a spot, if your eyes are open, a spot on the floor. It can be a sensation somewhere else in the body, or sounds. Different objects can be used. The idea is it's a one-pointed. So you're concentrating on one object. And bringing the mind back over and over again. And you can see how this amplifies mindfulness, right? So you can really be attentive then to what you can unitask. Even in your daily life, you can be more, you're more likely to be a unitasker, which is a dying skill. I saw this comic, this guy's coming into the office and the boss says, I need somebody, really a unique employee in this company. I've looked long. Can you find somebody that can unitask? He goes, oh, I don't know. That's a tall order. So really, that's what we're bringing to this practice is unitasking. And you can bring that into your daily life, this ability to be with one thing. And counting the breaths, some people find it helpful. Play with it, experiment with it, see if it's helpful to your practice. Don't get too attached to it. It's something that, you know, once in a while, it's a practice that can be helpful. Yeah. So another question at the back? Yeah?
Can you talk a little about the difference between concentration and self-discipline?
Difference between concentration and self-discipline. Well, this whole practice has an element of discipline, you could say, although that's one of those words that we can have a reaction to. The word the Buddha used more often was effort, wise effort, which means effort without striving, without grasping. So we bring this sense of discipline, effort, to our practice. Another favorite quote of the Buddha is, practice like your hair's on fire. That one really struck me the first time I heard that. And I heard it when my practice was getting kind of lazy. So I was just kind of like, oh yeah, I practiced every morning. But it was kind of getting, it's like, sort of a sleepy, almost like another sleepy, not asleep, but just kind of lazy. And then I heard this, the teacher said this, so, wow, like, I'm not practicing like my hair's on fire. I'm practicing like I'm lying in bed about to fall asleep. So there, that takes some discipline and some motivation and some effort. But again, without striving. So having said all that, there's a relaxing into it. There's a gentleness to it. So it's that dance between gentleness and compassion and kindness and effort and energy and fire. The fire of attention, bringing that to your practice. And if it takes some discipline to practice every day, there's going to be days when you go, I don't want to do this. We'll talk more about that, but yeah, there will be those days. So that takes some discipline. Another word the Buddha uses is faith. That's another word that we sometimes have a reaction to, which I think also links into discipline. It's a motive, there's going to be some sense of faith in this, that this is a practice, it's got a point. And it's not blind faith. One thing that attracted me to these teachings is it's not a faith just believe it. In fact, it's the opposite of blind faith. It's faith based on you're testing to see if it's true for you. Right, so it's like learning the heart. It's you don't believe it, just try it. And so even the counting, I said, play with it, see if it, or just play with all of these practices and see if they ring true for you. So I think that helps in the discipline or the motivation as having that faith. So I learned my faith is developed as I tested the teachings. It's okay, yeah, this is what happened. It rang true for me. Yeah. Thank you for the question. Yeah. Does noble silence include eye contact? Yes, it does. But I'm looking at you, but you don't really look at each other. So it's hard for me to talk without, I'll try not to. But there is, it's called, custody of the eyes. And, because we communicate a lot with our eye contact with each other. It's another aspect of having being with our experience internally. Yeah, so if you both come to the door at the same time, if you don't look at each other, it can be kind of awkward sometimes. So you just kind of, if you want the other person to go first, you just kind of, and if you both do that, then eventually somebody will go through the door. But yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, it's good. Custody of the eyes along with the not reading or writing and so forth. Yeah.
But this when you talked about the so the self compassion and the metta and the that with the concentration, is it either separate or can you find that you're screwing up or you're not the discipline isn't there? Is it important to focus more on the compassion
and the forgiveness, and the, or do you focus on the discipline more,
or on
this
weekend?
Yeah. Oh, so you're talking during the retreat? Yeah. Well, during the retreat and any time. Yeah. If you, all of these are trainings, so we begin again. And we begin again. So if we miss a day meditating, that's what happened. That's just what happened. You begin again the next. You have another moment, another chant, another time to begin. So that's the self-compassion permeates the entire practice. The wisdom practices and the compassion practices are like two wings of a bird, and you need both in order to for the practice to take off, to fly. That metaphor works for you. So it's so crucial, and I think it's particularly, we can be hard on ourselves or our own worst critics, right? So I think the self-compassion component is is so important. Watch when that self-critical, that voice starts going. Watch that self-talk. It can be quite hurtful. And just allow some compassion to come forth. These are just thoughts arising. They don't have to be taken as true about anything to do with who I am. Just thoughts arising based on cause and conditions in this moment. and, you know, you can do some metta practice, but you use the word metta, some metta or loving kindness practice, which is just actually calling forth, may I be well, may I be happy, may I be filled with loving kindness, may I love myself just the way I am, may I be free from mental suffering, may I be free from physical suffering. That's my personal loving kindness. So if I'm feeling like there's that critical voice, I'll start from that place of loving kindness. And of course, you can extend loving kindness to friends and relatives and all beings as well. So it's a very central part of this practice. Compassion, metta. Yes. Okay. The difference between investigation and analysis. So analysis is what we commonly do with our thinking mind. We plan, we we analyze options, use our critical thinking. Very, very valuable skills, intellectual intellectual skills that we have are crucial to our daily life, and it's part of being human. So we're not trying to get rid of that in any way, shape, or form. But insight meditation is a different process. It's clearly seeing and clearly knowing, but it's more of a visceral kind of knowing and seeing, as opposed to a cognitive knowing and seeing. And the knowing comes from just being with what's there and seeing it for what it is. It's kind of a felt sense. The mind is going to want to try and figure things out. But that's just, again, part of the practice. Mindfulness practice is watching the mind do what it does. It wants to figure things out. It wants to think about what's happening. So it's allowing, you know, allowing the mind to be without fighting with it. But that's part of your investigation, is noticing that that's what your mind does. So it can be, as investigation can be as simple as a noticing that when I sit to meditate, I'm new to this meditation. When I sit to meditate, my mind goes like it just thinks constantly. That's a very simple sort of level of invest. Just knowing that that's what your mind does when you sit quietly is actually quite useful. Not many people don't realize that their minds are constantly going, and you really don't notice it how much it thinks until you sit quietly and notice. So that's a very simple investigation. So I guess it's I'll go back to what the Pali word dhamma vikara is a sorting. So it's kind of a seeing what's arising moment by moment by really paying attention. And then seeing, and I think I use the example, seeing that, you know, if I watch violent TV, that anger is more likely to arise. So you start to see these connections. You start to see connections between, you know, that what causes what, the cycle of dependent origination, you know, what causes what within your experience. You might start to see from your experience certain things about reality that you didn't see. Again, not by thinking about it, but just by being with your experience and noticing what's arising. You may start to see things that you didn't see before. So you have, maybe I'll put it in an even simpler way, bring intense curiosity to what's arising, but not thinking about it. So it's non-cognitive. I was just thinking the insights were, you know, things that came when I read a lot of books. So I figured if I read a lot of books, I'd have more. And then I had a teacher say, you can only read for as long as you actually meditate. Because I used to read for like 8 hours and then meditate for an hour. So now I was being told, if I want to read for 8 hours, I have to meditate for 8 hours. And what he was pointing to was that this is not an intellectual activity. This is a practice. So we're investigating in our practice, in our lives, investigating what it is to be human. So it's not all that complicated, but I'm probably overcomplicating it. But bring real curious. So first we have to be present. So we have to have that momentary concentration, that access concentration, so we can be present with what's arising moment by moment. And then we have to bring this intense curiosity to what's arising moment by moment. not taking anything, not assuming we know anything about what's arising. Beginner's mind, bringing this like a child would bring to their fresh experience. Like I was with a small child who was to happen to be in a really, really grumpy mood over the holidays. I got up the wrong side of the bed kind of saying, well, this 4-year-old got up on the wrong because he just had a grump on, right? Everything was just what was, right? Who knows why? 4-year-old, I mean. And he was just grumpy. And you just kind of, you know, with a 4-year-old, you just kind of let them be, right? And a ladybug landed on his hand. Oh, wow. And he went from, you know, grump to this total amazement about this ladybug. And just to see, and I thought right at that moment, I thought, wow, this is invest. This is curiosity. This is being with, in that moment, with that ladybug. And ladybugs, I don't know, if they feel threatened, they play dead, right? That's why they just sit. We just sat there, and he thought this ladybug was like, you know, wanting to be with them and stuff, right? And he's really just playing dead because he felt. So the two of us just sat there looking at this ladybug, and eventually they figure these two ginormous beings aren't going to kill me, and they fly away. But his mood just changed from that little experience of mindfulness, investigation, and concentration. So that's, but for me, that captures kind of what we're after. It's a beginner's mind, that the mind of that, you know, just being with our experience as if it's for the first time. That breath. Can you be real curious about that breath each time? Each breath is different. Bringing that sense of curiosity, investigation to the breath. Okay, let's just settle in. We'll take a moment to settle in, to practice. So it won't be a lengthy meditation. I realize people may be sleepy, so I'll offer a short. We'll just have a short silent sitting, and then I'll ring the bells and you can move on to going to bed or continue to practice on your own.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.